Okay, it's 10 o'clock. We'll call this meeting to order. Winter, could you please call the roll?
Chair Treechalk?
Here.
Vice Chair Carter?
Present.
Regent Geddes?
Here.
Regent Hayes?
Here.
Regent Perkins? You have a quorum. Advisory member, Mr. Campbell?
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll move to agenda item number one, public comments. Do we have any public comments?
Thank you, Chair Treechalk. Yes, we do have several submissions that I will now read into the record. The first one is Samir Gulati. I believe it is imperative for the Nevada Board of Regents to move the NSHE in the direction of fossil fuel divestment as part of a comprehensive environmental reform within Nevada. Doing so would allow NSHE to be a progressive role model in the U.S. education system, bringing attention both to the distressing issue of fossil fuel reliance and highlighting the willingness of Nevadans to do what is best for our future. Setting this great example would be an inspiring move to many Nevadans, myself included, and is a necessary stepping stone in the long road we have in the fight against climate change. The next one is from Elizabeth Stevenson. We need to stop investing in fossil fuels. Students and communities demand a greener campus. The next one is from Molly Willoughby. I am an undergraduate student at the University of Nevada, Reno. I want to urge the committee to further consider the need for divestment from fossil fuel holdings for the Nevada higher education system. I applaud your progress thus far to make NSHE's asset managers report their consideration of climate change concerns in their investment decisions, and I see this as but a first step toward what must necessarily be a concerted effort to minimize as much as possible the fossil fuel exposure in the total endowment. I'm sure you've heard the environmental arguments, and of course, those are extremely important to me and have urged me to comment today. There is no solution to climate change that permits the continued use of fossil fuels, no matter how clean they are. At some point, something's got to give, and that point was arguably decades ago. Additionally, one can point to the increasing economic risks associated with the fossil industry. While it is unsurprising that oil prices have contracted so much during this unprecedented pandemic, it is also notable that predictions for the recovery are rather grim, with companies like Exxon liable to be dragged down by stranded assets that are worth much less than their purchase and development costs. This is simply one example of a growing volatility and continuing decline of the fossil fuel industry. Throughout history, when embargoes or other shocks have made oil inaccessible, Americans have shown that they are more than capable of conserving energy and shifting to alternative sources. This we must continue to do, and with cleaner energy options in mind. Universities across the nation have committed to divestment, and NSHE can do so as well, not only to lead in a transition away from harmful energy practices, but to remove ourselves from the fossil fuel market before it declines further. Finally, I ask you to consider divestment from a social equity standpoint. Our educational institutions strive to support diverse cultures and backgrounds in our student body, yet at the same time invest in fossil fuel assets, thereby supporting the industries that harm marginalized populations. Not only are people of color and low-income people disproportionately impacted by pollution from fossil fuel and related industries, but they are also those who bear the brunt of change impacts overall. For all these reasons, I ask that the NSHE Investment Committee commit to divestment. It is what the student body wants. It will benefit local and regional communities, and it is a moral and fiscal responsibility that sooner or later will be inevitable. The next comment is from Anna Zoters. Good afternoon, board and committee. My name is Anna Zoters, and I am an undergraduate student studying environmental science and chemistry at the University of Nevada, Reno. Through my classes and work in this field, I've come to appreciate and understand just how complex and important of an issue climate change is and how it affects and will continue to affect many aspects of our lives and the lives of generations to come. Global temperatures and the number of extreme weather events continue to increase as a result of anthropogenic emissions into the atmosphere, and it is extremely critical that we take action in whatever way possible to reverse these trends. I believe that completely divesting from fossil fuels would be a positive step towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and although this step may be small on the global scale, it makes a strong statement in our community. By making the effort to divest from fossil fuels and instead investing in cleaner, greener industries, the university will be able to show its commitment to being more environmentally responsible and aware. Thank you for your time and attention, and I hope you will strongly consider terminating this institution's reliance on fossil fuel investments. The next comment is from David Cutie. I am a student at UNR, and I believe I speak for many when I urge you to divest from fossil fuels. Take the lead of many other universities and do the right thing. The next is from Elizabeth Gulen. Hello, Regents. I'd first like to start off by thanking you for your time and flexibility during everything this year has thrown at us. My public comment is for the Investments Committee regarding the divestment of fossil fuels. On November 3rd, 2020, 747,581 Nevadans voted yes on ballot question 6, which states, shall Article 4 of the Nevada Constitution be amended to require beginning in calendar year 2022 that all providers of electric utility services who sell electricity to retail customers for consumption in Nevada generate or acquire incrementally larger percentages of electricity from renewable energy sources so that by calendar year 2030, not less than 50% of the total amount of electricity sold by each provider to its retail customers in Nevada comes from renewable energy resources. This voting outcome clearly shows the attitude towards fossil fuels held not only by ENCHI institution members but by Nevada citizens. To keep investments in fossil fuels is directly against the will of Nevadans. As one of the most powerful entities in Nevada, it is your civic duty to answer the call of Nevadans. As an individual, I do not have the perfect answer to how this should be executed. However, I do have full faith that this Board of Regents has the knowledge and the means to work collaboratively towards a better future for all of Nevada. If there is any way I can help, please contact me with the email left on this form. Thank you. The next is from Kian Zoters. Good afternoon, Board and Committee. My name is Kian Zoters, and I'm an undergraduate at the University of Nevada, Reno, studying chemical engineering. I am writing because it's concerning to me that the issue of divesting from fossil fuels has completely been taken off of the agenda. This would imply that this issue isn't even important enough to talk about, let alone be acted on. However, this couldn't be further from the truth. This issue should unequivocally be on the agenda because, as we have seen in the last round of state voting, the majority of Nevadans support the cause of renewable energy. I see it as incongruous that the majority of the Nevadan people support the implementation of renewable energy while the leading university in the state is unquestionably invested in fossil fuels. Universities in general represent investments in the future. Investments in education are investments in the health and prosperity of our community. So why can't this university divest in something that is so clearly not in the future? To be a place of enlightened thought and work that every university strives to be, the University of Nevada, Reno must at the very least consider the divestment from fossil fuels. If the rest of the state is moving towards 50% renewable energy in the next 10 years, it is time for the university to embrace this effort and divest from fossil fuels. The next is from Michael W. Collins. Don't allow ENCHI and its stakeholders to remain on the wrong side of oil and gas investments. From 1990 to 2005, McKinsey reports that firms in all segments of the oil and gas industry, except for refining and marketing firms, exceeded the total return to shareholders, TRS, for the S&P 500. In the 15 years that followed from 2005 to January 2020, every single segment of the industry underperformed the S&P 500 index by an average of 7% each year. Even if oil demand rebounds rapidly following COVID-19 back to 2019 levels, there is no reason to believe that the industry will produce superior risk adjusted compared with similar investments. While year-to-year performance fluctuations are expected, demand is unlikely to continue growing as consumers, businesses, and power producers begin to shift toward low-carbon technologies. Nevada is proof that the shift for utilities is already well underway. If the industry failed to provide long-term shareholder value from 2005 to 2019, in the absence of ambitious, enforceable climate goals, while demand was growing every year except 2008 to 2009, what are the odds that a recovery in the next 15 years will reverse the trend observed over the last 15 years? I will leave the committee with McKinsey's opening in their May 2020 brief. Quote, the oil and gas industry is experiencing its third price collapse in 12 years. After the first two shocks, the industry rebounded and businesses as usual continued. This time is different. The current context combines a supply shock with an unprecedented demand drop and a global humanitarian crisis. Additionally, the sector's financial and structural health is worse than in previous crises. The advent of shale, excessive supply, and generous financial markets that overlook the limited capital discipline have all contributed to poor returns, unquote. The next comment is from Rachel Perez Soto. I would like to acknowledge the fact that ENGIE institutions are contributing a substantial amount of their funds to fossil fuel companies. Considering the current state of the planet, this is unacceptable, and I would like to encourage many of the ENGIE institutions to divest from fossil fuels and invest in methods and companies that do better for the health of our planet. This has not been brought up in the previous meeting, and it is essential that it does in this meeting. Please divest from fossil fuels and create a plan that will help us achieve that. Our future is at stake, and climate change is the culprit. The next is from Taylor Valentine. Good morning. My name is Taylor Valentine, and I'm a senior at the University of Nevada, Reno. I study public health and environmental policy, and am a member of the UNR Environmental Club. For over 5 years now, students, faculty, and community members have asked this committee to divest from fossil fuels, reinvest in sustainable and socially responsible funds, and implement an environmental and social governance standard for all future investments. We know you have listened, requested more information, considered the different options, and had discussions. We thank you for the actions you have taken, but must continue to ask for more. Fossil fuels are a threat to the common good on so many levels. They threaten our planet, contributing to rising global temperatures, exacerbated natural disasters, climate refugees, species extinction, even the spread of disease. Fossil fuels threaten public health, contributing to asthma, cancer, chronic respiratory diseases, even higher COVID-19 mortality rates, all of which disproportionately affect communities of color and low socioeconomic standing. Fossil fuels threaten national security, food and water security, and biodiversity, while all the industry spends millions and millions on political lobbying and campaign contributions to dissuade policymakers from doing the right thing and ending their assault on the nation's welfare. I know fossil fuels make up only a small percentage of the ENGIE investment portfolio, though that is still millions of dollars of investments. This is all the more reasons to act swiftly and commit to an entirely fossil-free portfolio. Thousands of institutions have done this successfully, with over $11 trillion having been divested from fossil fuels to date. This eventful year has been a catalyst for change in so many areas of our society. With renewed attention to our climate, public health, and social equity, increased political awareness and participation, and a new administration with climate initiatives as a priority, there's no better time to act. ENGIE has an opportunity to become one of the leading institutions in the movement towards environmental and social responsibility, bringing positive attention to our schools and inspiring students and leaders across our state. I urge the committee to take action and continue these conversations. Our investment policy should reflect the values of our institutions, specifically integrity and the betterment of society. It's the right thing to do, and it's what students want. Thank you for your attention and for continuing to listen to students' voices. The final comment is from Helena Middleton. Hello, I care very deeply about the environment and sustainability. In order for future generations to thrive, I am asking you to please fully divest from fossil fuels. I love living in Reno, but our high desert ecosystem is fragile, and the changing climate is putting our home at risk. Please do the right thing and divest from fossil fuels. Thank you. Mr. Chair, that's all we have for public comment at this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's move to agenda item number two. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting?
Geddes would move approval.
Second?
Perkins will second.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any nays? Passes unanimously. We'll move to agenda item number 3, Chair's Report. First of all, I would like to thank Andrew and your team for all the support that you provided to the board and to the committee, especially as it pertains to our investment activities. And I also would like to especially thank Russell Campbell for his tireless work in providing this committee with his expertise in an area where I certainly have no expertise and look to people like Russell for guidance in this very important role that we play in overseeing our outsourced chief investment officers and the performance of the various pools that we oversee. I think it's incumbent upon this committee and the board to ensure that we continually examine the performance of our OCIOs so that we can assure all of the donors throughout the state and country who've chosen to invest in ENSHI and in the various institutions that their investment will always be protected. So again, I thank all of you, and that's the end of my report. So we'll move now to agenda item number 4, which is for information only. And Andrew, I'll turn this over to you. This is the comparison of the performance of the two ENSHI pools and then the performance of the various foundations. And I think it's important, Andrew, for the record, if you could explain again the difference on how we have within our system these different groups of funds and who's in control of the investing for each of those funds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Andrew Klinger, Chief Financial Officer for ENSHI. So the comparative report, this was a report that was requested to be presented at the September 29th meeting. So the report before you today, as the chair has laid out, compares the ENSHI Endowment Fund with the two university foundations, which are separate but related entities to the ENSHI Endowment. So the ENSHI Endowment, just to give a little background as the chair has requested, the ENSHI Endowment is managed by the investment committee with two outsourced chief investment officers, Cambridge and Associates and Russell Investments. The foundations have their own board of trustees and their own investment committee that manages their funds. Now, at the end of the day, the Board of Regents still have oversight over those foundation funds, but they are managed on a day-to-day basis separately from the ENSHI Endowment. The report that's presented and was requested by this board at its last meeting presents the a comparison of the asset allocation between the three different funds, as well as the historical returns, the annual rates of return, and the inflows and outflows for the three different institutions. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to go through the numbers in detail, line item by line item, but we do have our OCIOs on the line, as well as representatives from the foundation, if there are specific questions that you would like to get into, Mr. Chairman.
What I'd like to do first, I'd like to have Russell weigh in, if he could, please, and then we'll turn it over to members of the committee if they have any questions of either of our OCIOs or the chairs of the investment committees of the UNLV and the UNR Foundation. So we'll start with you, Russ.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm an analyst, and clearly a one-page synopsis summary of numbers doesn't give me enough information to really express, you know, what should be done, what are the implications of all this. But what I will say is a couple of things. First of all, ENGIE historically has generally outperformed during good periods of time relative to UNR and the UNLV foundations. But when results are, when returns in the market are lower or negative, the UNR and UNLV foundations tend to do better. The implication is that there is somewhat higher risk in the ENGIE portfolio, which, since this is a long-term portfolio, suggests that the returns will also be higher. We have very professional OCIOs running this operation. We monitor them quite closely. And I think what we've seen is a historical pattern that you might expect, slightly higher risk than the other two foundations. But overall, the ENGIE fund has held up very well. I would say, though, more broadly, all three funds could be doing better. If you look at the results from large foundations as of the end of the last fiscal year, all three foundations have actually underperformed. Now, it's not unusual for endowments of this size to not do as well as the largest foundations in the country. However, we have top-notch professional OCIOs that I think could help us to increase our returns even further. And I think if Cambridge comes on the line or Russell Investments come on the line, they'll support what I'm saying. And what they'll probably indicate is that we should have much more in the way of private equity investments in this, in our ENGIE fund and probably in the UNLV and UNR funds as well. And so that's probably a direction that they'll take. There are other things as well that we can do. But I think that overall, all of the funds are doing okay relative to other endowment funds of their size, but we could be doing even better. That would be my sort of summary.
Thank you. And Wendy, I know we have you here from Cambridge. Do we have somebody here from Russell?
Yeah, good morning. This is Matt Beard, Sam on the line.
Hello, Matt. Well, let's start with Wendy. Wendy, could you address some of the points that were raised by Russell before we go to committee members for questions they might have of either you or Matt?
Yes, sure. I think Mr. Campbell's observations, I would not argue with any of them. I would also add that when we look at risk, you know, we're thinking of risk along two dimensions. One is short-term drawdown risk, which is, I think, what Russell Campbell's observations really touched upon. And I think you can see that in our fiscal year 2020 results, performance was weaker, particularly as a result of the first quarter pullback in the markets, in the equity markets. We also, and I think he alluded to this in his commentary about these being long-term pools, we try to think quite a bit about the risk of not keeping pace with this pool's payout on a real basis, net of inflation. And when we think about risk, that's a risk that perhaps we all feel somewhat less acutely because it's not the immediate, you know, stomach churning market drop risk. But when we think about probabilities, that is a more likely risk that most long-term institutions face in the current environment, particularly given valuations. And it's that is extremely acute in the fixed income space. You know, when I look at these most recent 5 years of historical returns, I'm very comfortable with the last 4 years since Cambridge was hired as OCIO. The green numbers we've sort of stripped out and just hypothesized what if Cambridge had been running this whole pool. And, you know, out of these last 4 years, we ranked ahead of the two foundations in two out of the 4 years. We were in the middle on one of the 4 years, and then we placed third in the most recent fiscal year. And in this most recent fiscal year, I think the biggest driver, if you look at the fixed income allocations up above, the two foundations have nearly double the fixed income exposure, which does lead to less volatile performance. But with bond yields where they are today, We don't think that's going to drive the type of support that the payout from this pool requires. So, you know, it's all trade-offs here. So I think that's the biggest context that I would give to our third place performance in the most recent fiscal year.
Could you just address the one point that was raised by Russell, and that has to do with our underperformance in comparison to other larger foundations?
So yes, so most very large a significantly higher allocation to private investments, as he noted. I'm looking at, we have our flash statistics for colleges and universities. The median return was 2.1%, but the trend is that the higher up in the distribution ranking, there's a pretty direct correlation to the institutions with the highest percentage in private investments. So in our Cambridge portfolio, we have been allocating quite a lot, making new commitments to a number of new private investment funds. These funds, however, take many years to call capital and make new investments. So it's not something where we can flip a switch and overnight have, you know, a 30% exposure to private investments. It just takes a long time to build, and we're on our way. And perhaps as a bit of an aside, this also reflects a great opportunity to align ourselves with the public comment, many of the public comments made, because for the last 3.5 years, we have made a number of commitments to private strategies that are focused on renewable energy, sustainable real assets. We haven't made a traditional oil and gas commitment in the last 3.5 years. Our most recent one was to a renewable infrastructure fund that was a €2 million or about $2.4 million commitment that we made just last month. So this is an area where we agree with many of the public commenters that the opportunity set is very, very robust and attractive on a purely return basis, because we agree that this is the direction that the energy systems are going. And then it also, as a bonus, provides, I think, very positive alignment with the goals of the institutions in the energy system.
Thank you. And Matt, we'll turn to you. And after Matt, I was remiss in not addressing the chairs of the investment committees from the UNR and the UNLV foundations. And so after Matt, then I think it would be appropriate to hear first from the UNLV chair, if he or she is on the line, and the same then from UNR, and then we'll go to questions from members of the committees. Thanks, Wendy. Matt.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. I don't know if there's much I would add to Wendy's comments. Honestly, I would concur with the majority of what she said. The risk profile of the portfolio that we've built for you folks is in keeping with that long-term kind of objective that you need, the spending policy that you have. And it'd be lovely to think that we could have a portfolio that generates all the return with none of the risk, but there is a kind of a hand-in-glove relationship that has to exist there. So I think the portfolio is built in a way that it makes sense. As I look at the since inception returns, and this is going to sound a little strange, of the benchmark that we use, which I think is a fair depiction of the strategic portfolio we've sought to build for you folks, you know, that's generated around 6.5%. That's sufficient even after the presence of inflation to achieve the objective. Russell Investments is underdelivered on a realized basis relative to that, and a lot of that we've discussed in previous meetings about our investment thesis right now in the marketplace related to value and growth. But as I related to Andrew Klinger and Rhett yesterday in a call that we had, our portfolio is starting to behave a lot better in the last couple of months, and we're encouraged by that, and we see brighter things ahead. So the portfolio strategically we think is well put together. Tactically, we've made some missteps, if you will, but we think those are starting to come around. To the question in regards to how we might be able to achieve better peer relative results, yes, agreed with Mr. Campbell and Ms. Walker's comments about more private equity. What you'll notice is that the Russell investment portfolio does not have private equity in it yet, and that's actually purposeful. There is a an element of limitation on how far we can deploy into that particular asset class, given the historical investments by the endowment in that asset class. And so we've been holding off until such time we could do so in a more robust way. We're getting closer to that point, and I would expect us in probably 2021 to begin that program for you. To Wendy's point, I think it's an important one. In the private space, there are some more unique opportunities that can be had, and you know, deploying into things that are more aligned with kind of the stakeholder desires for Nevada is certainly something that we can look to. Also, you may recall Russell Investments launched a low-carbon vehicle, a low-carbon variant of the multi-asset core fund that we have in place in your portfolio. That portfolio launched on July 1st, and we already have $500 million worth of client money in it. We are seeing tremendous interest from our nonprofit clientele to move towards even liquid solutions that have lower carbon footprints, and we're very encouraged by that. We think that's the trend that's going to continue. So, long story short, you know, I think things are turning a little bit better on Russell's side for performance. We're encouraged by that. We look forward to seeing that continue, and hopefully when I get an opportunity to update you with more detailed information in, I believe it's the March timeframe, there'll be some good news there to share.
Thanks, Matt. UNLV Foundation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Ricky McCurry. I am the new president of UNLV Foundation. I'm in my 61st day, so it's good to be with you. Our investment chair was unable to attend today, but I'm here, and our CFO Tiffany Vickers is here, so we will do our best to try to answer any questions that the committee might have.
And thanks for being here, Ricky. Do you have anything that you would like to share with us based on the foundation's performance?
Well, I would only say that in listening to the earlier comments and my experience at some other universities, when I look at our asset allocation, I would agree that we may want to look at the private equity space a little more because we are at a small percentage of our overall investments in private equity. And I think just from a university perspective across the country of universities of our size, private equity is not a place where we have normally played in that space. But I think we all are beginning to take a look at that space a lot more closely, and I expect our foundation and our investment committee will be doing the same.
Great, thank you. Mark, good seeing you.
Hello, Rick.
What would you like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Densler, chair of the UNR Foundation. We're really quite pleased overall with our results, and I think this goes back to Russell's comments. Is when we look down at our Sharpe ratios on a risk-adjusted basis, because what we look at, again, as Wendy mentioned, is the long-term risks of not being able to meet our spend. And so we're very, very targeted at protecting to the downside, even if it does require us to give up a little bit on the upside. But having said that, we've been very actively moving into private equity. But the one caution about private equity is it's no free lunch. There's obviously the liquidity issues, but even more, there is a significant administrative burden on the back office that needs to be taken into account if you're moving into a private equity environment to administer all the capital calls, distributions, being able to do the valuation processes. And so those are all things that have to be taken into account. The other issue around moving into private equity is private equity generally is not paying you the returns that you need if you're not in successfully getting in the first two quartiles. There's an awful lot of opportunities out there that you would not want to be in. So it is something that has to be moved in carefully, especially with foundations of this size. So I just offer that up as some of the caveats that while it is an area to go looking for greater returns, and especially long-term returns for an endowment like we're all administering, it has to be entered into, obviously, with the complete picture of how you're going to add it to the portfolio and actually administer it. And obviously, one way that smaller endowments get into it is through fund of funds, but then you have an extra layer of fees, and so you have to evaluate all of the above as part of that. The other point I'd like to add is that UNR, we spent this last year actually going through a very extensive kind of education program that we called Preparing for Climate Change on the portfolio. And, you know, the comments that were made at the beginning with the students certainly are echoed throughout the country, but all of us, we take our fiduciary obligation very, very seriously, that first and foremost, we're here to earn a return to be able to enable the universities to do what they need to be able to do as a institution. And certainly we're obligated under the NRS to pay attention to those type of things. So it's a balancing act, but I think we have determined that there are very sound economic reasons to be able to look at why you do not want to be in this space any longer. We at UNR have not invested, as Wendy was talking about, for Nietzsche. We have not invested any traditional oil and gas now for several years, and in fact are pivoting the portfolio in the direction that takes us in, you know, something that is probably more aligned with what the students are actually looking for. But the problem is it's a tricky issue because calling for divestiture sounds good, but there is an economic cost for full divestiture. And we're taking an approach at UNR to run off the existing portfolio to maximize the economics, but actually, as I said, pivot the future. So all of that is kind of the focus to address the various topics that we've talked about here so far today.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ricky, and thanks, Mark, for your contributions and for attending today and sharing your thoughts with us. That brings us now to members of the committee. Do any members of the committee have any questions, either of Russell, Matt, Wendy, or Ricky or Mark?
Mr. Chair, if I may, just a comment. I really appreciate the addressing the issues that were brought up during the public comment about our diversification from fossil fuels. I really appreciate everybody paying attention to that.
Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair?
Okay, Regent Geddes and Regent Carter?
Yeah, and basically I had just a comment on that. And part of the discussion that we've had as we've looked at divestment through the years and investment through the years has been the fact that Nevada doesn't have any coal or natural gas or oil. We have none of those resources. If we actually want to work on Nevada's economy, the investments in renewable energy and energy storage and those sorts of issues are what is important to Nevada long-term as well as the Nevada system for education. But I appreciate that we're pivoting. I realize that there's a loss coming from that, and it takes a while to pivot, but I would encourage us to pivot faster. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Carter.
Sure, my concern is kind of the same as it was last year. So looking at our management fee, and it looks like we have allocated up to 1.5% versus like UNR's foundation that's operating at 0.5%. I was just hoping for a little insight on what the difference is or what we're getting for our extra 1%.
We'll start with Wendy, we'll go to Matt, and then we can have Ricky and Mark jump in and address the question.
I believe the management fee is what each campus is allowed to take from its distribution. I think that's the number that he's referring to on this sheet, if I'm not mistaken. So it's within the 4.5% payout rate, target payout rate. Each institution can take up to 1.5% as a management fee, but that goes to the institutions rather than this is not an investment management fee.
Oh, sorry, I misread it. Where on that sheet does it have the fees that we're paying for our management of the fund?
Yeah, no, that's actually, it's a management fee within the payout to the institutions. That's not a management fee to managers or to Cambridge. That this is a technicality. So this 1.5% is, you can see in footnote 4, each institution will have the discretion to allocate proceeds between spending on programs and the management fee. I believe each institution can use that 1.5% for a variety of internal purposes, but maybe Mr. Klinger could provide more insights there, or either representative from either foundation. I think it's a more clear-cut use of the management fee at each of the foundations.
Speaking of for UNR, our 0.5, this represents sort of the administrative costs, you know, to help contribute to the running of the foundation. So as I was alluding to, you know, things like private equity, you know, all the accounting, all the auditing, all the rest of that, you have to cover for those type of it. It's not actually the running of the investment per se, but the administrative cost of actually providing the infrastructure in which the investment process takes place.
Matt?
I'm not sure there's much I can add to Wendy's remarks about the cost of running the foundations. I can update you on the fees that Russell is charging as an asset manager to NSHE, and we disclosed that in our September meeting, if I recall correctly, but I'm happy to update Regent Carter on that if you'd like, sir. Is that a benefit?
I think that's okay for right now, but I guess Andrew might be the person to best answer my question then.
So, Mr. Chairman, Andrew Klinger for the record. So I think not much to add to what Wendy said either. The 1.5% is within the target spending rate, and that does go to the institution. So it's not funds that are retained at the NSHE level. Those are funds that go out to the institution. So certainly, and I think we have some of the business officers from the institutions, and perhaps they can explain how they use those funds better than I could.
Mr. Chairman, Ricky McCurry from the UNLV Foundation. I would just add one point, and I agree with the gentleman from UNR in terms of the fees being used to help offset the cost of operating the foundation. I would just add the distinction between what the UNR figure is and the UNLV figure really relates to how each institution chooses to fund the operations of its foundation. There are different methods by which you do that, and so we just have a larger percentage of our foundation operations been funded through the management fee as compared to our colleagues at UNR.
Mark Denzler for UNR. I will mention that we've had a philosophy of trying to drive those fees down to the absolute minimum. They used to be at a 1% level. We took it down to a 0.6, and now it's at a 0.5. It just represents trying to make it as efficient as possible and leave the maximum amount in the foundation to grow, provide a bigger base, which obviously even at a 4.5% payout, a bigger base, it's a bigger dollar amount. So that's the philosophical approach that UNR has taken.
Any other questions? I have one question, Mark, the Densler, and
yes.
Ricky, the committee doesn't do its own investing. You use investment advisors or managers to whom fees are paid as well?
That is correct, Rick. At UNR, our outside advisor is Wilshire, but it's not an outsourced CIO model. All the investment decisions are made by my committee with the advice and input from Wilshire, and then Wilshire helps us execute. So Wilshire will serve up discussions around asset allocation, around expected returns on asset classes. The committee then debates that process, settles on an asset allocation model, and then we continue to make sure that we are implementing that model to the best of the effect with managers' selection process that is teed up by Wilshire. But all the decisions are made actually at the committee, and the committee are all, you know, trustees that have been, appointed as part of UNR.
With
the
with expertise in this area?
Pardon me?
The committee members have expertise in the investment field?
Yes. So just for instance, in my own case, I'm the COO of a large endowment private family office with a CFA. The vice chair that works with me also is currently an investment professional here in town with Whittier. So we have at least a third of the investment committee with direct current working in the investment world. Probably a third of them are very familiar right now with fossil fuel and renewable resources in the mining industry, given our Mackey School of Mines. That's another group that's with there that provides great insight into, you know, real assets.
Thank you. Ricky, is there anything you would like to add?
Just Mr. Chairman, I would just say that we operate the exact same way as Mark just laid out for UNR. The only difference is that our advisor is a group by the name of Callan.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to agenda item number 5, handbook revision, statement of investment objectives and policies for the operating funds. Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Andrew Klinger. So item 5 is a request to make changes to the investment objectives and policies for specifically for the operating funds, and specifically within that to make changes to the way we do the distributions. And really the purpose for this new policy is to better manage the balance in the operating pool reserve. And remember, for the committee, the operating pool reserve is where we made some of the large distributions to offset some of the budget reductions that were requested by the state of Nevada. So what we're requesting is basically a floor, what I would call a floor and a ceiling within the policy, and the floor being at 3%. And the way the proposed policy reads right now, and I have a revision to that that I'll get to in a second, but the way the policy reads right now in your material is that if the reserve balance is less than 3% of the total operating pool on the last day of the month, then we will not make a distribution for that month. The other side of that is that if that balance, that operating pool reserve balance, is greater than 8% of the total operating pool on the last day of the month, then the excess above 8% would be distributed to the institutions after making the monthly distributions. Now, I did receive late yesterday, and so I apologize that it's not in front of the committee, a suggested change from the business officers. And that would be to instead of 3% on the last day of the month, it would be the last day of the month for 3 consecutive months. So this would smooth out sort of the ups and downs. So I think it's a good suggestion. So the change there would be, and just let me read it so that it's on the record since you don't have it in front of you. Here is the wording. If the reserve balance in the operating pool is negative on the last day of the month, the Inchi Banking and Investment Office will not make a distribution for that month. So if the balance is negative, we don't make a distribution. The next part is if the reserve balance in the operating pool falls below 3% of the total operating pool on the last day of the month for 3 consecutive months, the Inchi Banking and Investment Office will withhold distributions until the reserve balance returns to a 3% balance. And then finally, if the reserve balance in the operating pool is greater than 8% of the total operating pool on the last day of the month for 3 consecutive months, the Inchi Banking and Investment Office will distribute the amount of the reserve above 8% after making the monthly distribution. So that would be a recommended change to what is in front of you within the supplemental material. There's also included in there a handout that shows the impact based on the wording of the current policy. So basically what would happen is Right now, we do, you know, the monthly distributions based on a 2.75% rate. This policy would then be make automatic special distributions, if you will, above that 8%. And if the committee adopts the 3 months, it would have to be above 8% for 3 months. And then it also suspends distributions if the balance drops below 3% for three consecutive months.
Thank you. Do we have any of the business officers from any of the institutions on the call today?
We do. I know Vic Redding is on. I see Jim New. I'm just looking at the list of names. So we do have some of them on the line.
But I would ask, and we'll start with Vic, and then we'll go to Jim and to anybody else, any other business officer. I would like to hear your comments or inputs on the proposed handbook change as amended. In other words, instead of looking at it monthly, we would look at it over a three-month period to make the either automatic distribution or that there would be no distribution. So we'll go Vic, Jim, and then Gene, if that's okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This is Regent Geddes. Just a quick question before they address that is, I want to understand if that's it's evaluated every month on a roll, that rolling average is looked at every month, or when it goes above 3 and below 8, or if it's reviewed quarterly. So if they could just address that when they speak. Thank you, sir.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like me to address that, the way the, for the record, Andrew Klinger, Chief Financial Officer, the way the language is written right now is it's looked at the end of every month, but for a distribution to be made above 8%, you have to end above 8% for three consecutive months. And the same on the downside, you have to end below 3% for three consecutive months in order for distributions to be suspended. Unless you end up going below zero, then you suspend the distributions as well.
If I understand it, Andrew, we examine this every month, but we only make these decisions based on a rolling three-month average.
Yes.
Okay, Vic.
Yes, thank you, Regent Trachok. For the record, Vic Redding, Vice President, Administration and Finance for University of Nevada, Reno, and fully support this this policy with the amendments that CFO Klinger just put on the record. Solves a couple of problems for us. Putting these triggers in will allow more rapid response, both in up markets and down markets, and not have to wait for semi-annual meetings of the investment committee and the posting time associated with that. So I think you'll see the distributions much more responsive to market conditions up and down. Will assist in cash flow projections, at least in my institutional budget, being able to evaluate and adjust these on that rolling basis that CFO Klinger made. Getting those types of inflows on a more predictable basis frees up a lot of possibilities as we use those for ongoing operating budget issues. Having a series of one-time distributions, while we've certainly appreciated those over the years, it's more limited as to what we can use those one-time lump sums for. They're not predictable, and you can't count on them reoccurring. So fully in support of this new methodology, and absolutely appreciate CFO Klinger's bringing this to the business officers to move it forward.
Thank you. Jim.
Thank you, Chair Trachok. And as usual, Vice President Redding has said just about everything I could add to the conversation. He's done a wonderful job. I do support the proposal, and it does bring predictability to the distributions that is not sorely needed, but greatly appreciated by the institutions for these funds. Vice President Bach was the individual who suggested the three-month average, so I will defer to her to explain the benefits of that, but I am fully in support of that proposal as well.
That's why we have Gene batting cleanup. Oh, you're on mute, Gene.
Thank you. Thank you, Regent Trachak. And for the record, Jean Bach, Senior Vice President for Business Affairs and CFO, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. As Jim noted, we our team did recommend that we modify the wording to provide some smoothing, so to speak. That is pretty common in determining investment distribution, so that one-time aberrations in the market, such as what we saw back in March, April, wouldn't necessarily trigger an immediate change. And so we did recommend the three-month smoothing. We think it'll be more easier to implement, and it'll make sure that we don't have to suddenly plan for a quick drop or a quick increase. So it gives us more predictability planning. But yeah, pretty much the same thing that Vic Redding and Jim New shared, and Andrew presented it quite well. So we're very supportive.
Thank you. Before we get to questions from members of the committee or comments, do I have a motion to approve the handbook revision with the change to a three-month rolling average as opposed to the month-by-month?
Geddes so moves.
I have a motion by Regent Geddes. We have a second. Regent Perkins?
Second.
Second, Regent Hayes. Okay, questions. Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So just a clarification question. So this would end our practice of doing special distributions where we kind of ask for a specific area that they want to have or spend that special distribution. Does it just be an automatic distribution?
Andrew?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Andrew Klinger, Chief Financial Officer. That is correct, because what this would do is, once the balances are above 8% for three consecutive months, those distributions would then be made to the institutions. So, Regent Carter, you're absolutely correct. There wouldn't be excess reserves to do a special distribution like was done back in, I believe it was August, when when the board approved those special distributions for budget reduction. So you are correct.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Hi, it's Russell Campbell.
Russell.
Hi. I don't mean to derail this, but something that the CFO and the regents might consider is creating some sort of high watermark for this. And by that, I mean, if you have a down market of 20%, 50%, that just because you have three subsequent months that are 3% or more, you're not back to where you were. So you're really eroding the principle of the operating pool, I think, if you make a payout based on the last 3 months after a severe downturn. So I'm just offering it up for consideration. I don't want to derail the amendment or the proposal at this moment, but it's something that perhaps Andrew Klinger and I could discuss later about creating some form of high watermark to that you have to get back to before you start making payouts again. Just a suggestion.
Andrew, could you address that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Andrew Klinger, Chief Financial Officer. And I think I understand what Mr. Campbell is saying. And the way it's structured now with the revised language is that it takes, I guess, three consecutive months below 3% to suspend the distribution, but only 1 month coming back to reinstitute the distributions, and maybe that's what you're referring to, Mr. Campbell. So you could be down, you could be below the 3% level for 3 months, which then suspends the distributions, and then the next month you could be at 4%, and now you're distributing the funds again. So are you suggesting that you have to get back to, say, 5% or some other level before the distributions would be made? Is that the way I understand that? I mean,
yes.
I'm just picking a number.
Yes. You know, think of it this way. If you have $100 million and it drops to $70 million, and then all of a sudden you're back at the 3% level for three consecutive months, you're paying on a base of $70 million, but you haven't gotten back to the $100 million yet. So maybe you need to get back to, and again, this is just a suggestion. I'll have lots of CFOs in the audience that will jump all over me. But the idea is to get back to some close to some previous level before you start making these distributions. Otherwise, you're going to be paying out on the basis of a very low, relatively low principal amount because of market conditions.
Could we hear from Gene, Vic, and Jim on this this question here? And as I understand it, again, what you're suggesting, Russell, and we appreciate your input here, you're suggesting that we maintain a baseline of value for the pool. And if we ever drop below that baseline, we can't make these automatic distributions until we go back up to the baseline.
Correct.
Okay, Gene, what are your thoughts on that?
Thank you, Regent Trachuk. And it's a valid comment. I think that the baseline is really kind of a separate discussion. And what I would suggest is that we move forward with this, but bring that back to for a further discussion of whether or not we also want to institute another level where we look at baseline. Because today, 100 million going down to 70 million, we don't know if our principal, you know, what was our really our underlying value. If it went from 50 to 100 and then down to 70, we're still above the 50. So it's a much more complex discussion. And I don't think it precludes us from doing this, but we could later on add some sort of criteria to consider a baseline. Because I think that is a related but different issue. That's my thought.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Vic.
Thank you. Intriguing comment, Russell, and I've been chewing on that. And I think what I would add, I'm sorry for the record, Vic Redding, University of Reno. What I would add to that is this is probably the time to do that liquidity analysis and see what the actual short-term, medium-term, and long-term cash flow needs are. As I look at the balance of the pool on the last page of the reference material, actually I think it's on both of the last two pages over the last 12 months, runs from a low of 720 million to a high of 922 million. You know, clearly there's a layer at the top where there'll be a lot of churn as fees come in and then monthly obligations are met. But there's a layer in that will never almost never be subject to cash flow ins and outs. So I would echo Vice President Bach's recommendation that this is the right place to start with a 3% minimum reserve and then a ceiling of an 8% maximum reserve. But perhaps the committee would want to charge the business officers with doing that liquidity analysis through the entire operating pool. To go to the heart of Russell's question, at least as I understand it, to make sure we don't find ourselves in a liquidity problem.
Thank you. Jim, anything to add?
Thank you, Regent Trachuk. And I do echo the comments made by my colleagues. Jim New, VP of Finance and Administration at TMCC, for the record. Also notable that a substantial decline would also result in, when it started to recover, the distributions themselves would be much smaller based on the principle as I understand it. And so I do support Vic's recommendation that the business officers conduct the liquidity study, but I do believe this is a very strong starting point for this policy.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, can I make one comment, just one thing to add?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Andrew Klinger, CFO. The other thing I would point out is that when we do this, we're looking at the operating pool reserve, which is not the principal. It only represents the realized and unrealized gains. So at no time, the way this is written, would you be distributing principal. I mean, in fact, that wouldn't make sense, actually. So what we're talking about in the operating pool reserve is just the realized, unrealized gains and any investment income that we have, which I think is an important distinction.
Yeah, thank you. That's very helpful to bring us back to the what we're talking about. Are there any other questions?
Chair Trachuk, this is Council Joe Reynolds. Just want to clarify before the board votes that the motion and the second are to approve the handbook amendments as verbally read into the record by CFO Klinger.
That's correct. No other questions or comments? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the passes unanimously. Russell, thank you very much. Andrew, thank you very much for your input on that. And especially I want to thank the three business officers who are on the line to keep this discussion focused and on track. Okay, the last, the second to the last agenda item is handbook revision statement of investment objectives and policies for the endowment fund for possible action. I'll go to you, Andrew, but what I'd like to do as I introduce this item, this was my request. We found that it's so extraordinarily helpful to have somebody like Russell, who's an advisory member, ad hoc member of this committee. And I thought it would be very helpful going forward for the committee, whoever sits on that committee, to have not only Russell's input and advice, but also to have on an ongoing basis the chair of the two largest, the chairs of the two largest foundations, the UNR Foundation and the UNLV Foundation, that they would automatically be ex officio members of this committee, sitting in the same role as Russell is sitting in. The chair always has the power to name ex officio members, but I think it's important to institutionalize this process so that it just happens automatically on a going forward basis. Andrew, is there anything that you would like to add?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Andrew Klinger, CFO, I think you summed it up very well. The language just specifically adds the chairs of the investment committee from the two foundations as ex officio non-voting members of the committee to provide advice for items involving the ENCHI endowment fund. And I would point out that the 75%, I guess, of the ENCHI endowment fund is designated for the university. So it is the obviously the largest share.
And before I go to members of the committee for a motion and a second, I think we probably should hear from Mark and Mark Gensler and Ricky, who will be drafted into this role without asking their consent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Mark Gensler from UNR Foundation. I'm actually just at the end of my tenure as the committee chair and will be rotating off as emeritus for a year. But I do think it is a good idea and a way for all three of the substantial endowments to better coordinate sort of thoughts and best ideas. So UNR is in favor of this.
Thank you. Ricky, what do you think about being drafted?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ricky McCurry, for the record, as the new UNLV Foundation president, I am willing to go out on a limb and commit our investment chair to sit on this committee. I think he would appreciate it, and we think it's a great idea, and we appreciate you thinking of it.
Thank you. Do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Regent Carter, second. Regent Hayes?
I have a question.
Do I have a second first?
Second.
Regent Geddes. Regent Hayes.
Yeah, I like the idea of having the input from the two universities, but I was wondering if we wanted to make it as specific as it being the two chairs of their investment committees. It could be another appointee of their foundation executive board, or if there could come an instance where they have someone that would be really good at this, or their chair of the committee doesn't necessarily have time. So if we can make it the chair and or designee of their investment committee or designee of the foundation. As we just heard, we've got a new person coming in at one of the universities, and we're kind of saying, hey, here's a new job for you. I like having the foundations having input. I just don't know that we need to make it as specific as the one person who chairs that committee. It could be, or designee, I guess.
Regent Carter, would that be acceptable as a friendly amendment?
Absolutely.
Regent Geddes?
Absolutely.
Any other questions or comments? Thanks, Trev, that's very helpful. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Passes unanimously. Thank you very much. And thanks for that amendment. That makes a lot more sense. Let's move now to Andrew, thanks for your help on that. That was getting this done in such short order. And Joe, you as well. So the next item is new business, agenda item number 7. Do we have any new business? Seeing none, we'll move now to agenda item number 8, public comment. Is there any public comment?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we have one public comment from Elena De La Paz. As a student of this institution and a leader of the student resident halls, it is our responsibility to push for the needed changes within our education environment. You as leaders should know and understand the damages that any large institution takes part in when they are not considering the impact of their inaction. I ask you to please investigate alternatives in energy as well as recycling efficiency and commit to carbon neutrality. Living in the residence halls, the student body has been an audience in seeing the actions that other institutions across the country are taking part of by divesting from fossil fuels and looking into alternatives for energy as well as making environmental impact a conversation with any investments. Considering this year's catastrophes, the ease of disease spreading is something also directly impacted by environmental damages to our air, water, and land, and we must continue to learn from our mistakes and build on how we are treating our world with more care. On behalf of the Residential Hall Association, we support this effort in taking responsibility in our institution's environmental sustainability through real action. That is all we have for public comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, this meeting is adjourned. Before we adjourn, I want to thank Wendy and Joe and Russell and Andrew, our business officers, and everybody for your help and support. And especially want to thank Ricky and Mark from the foundations. Meeting's adjourned.